hours back. It looks like a cargo pod was ejected from the Big Mac while the forward section was in the upper atmosphere.
Cargo?
The commander of the Legion's UNEF contingent exploded. Seeing the general's frustration, Vereni got to the point. The AI thinks there is a good possibility. He did not cite percentages, knowing that Ross didn't appreciate getting bogged down in details. That we detected smoke signals on the surface, he finished with a raised eyebrow.
Smoke?
Ross sat back in his chair. He had to trust that his staff wouldn't waste his time, but...
There's a lot of smoke down there, Major.
Not smoke that is puffing SOS in Morse code, sir.
SOS?
Ross tried to remember the ancient code for those letters. 3 dots, 3 dashes, 3 dots.
You are sure?
The AI is sure, Vereni clarified.
Well, I'll be damned. That's gotta be humans. They came down in a cargo container?
Either that or they halo-jumped from orbit.
Ross shook his head.
The Big Mac had not been carrying any commandos equipped with the gear for an orbital parachute drop.
If all we have is some funky puffs of smoke,
that's not all. 140 clicks east of those smoke signals is the crash site of that last dropship to get out of the Big Mac. We haven't been able to clear up any better the sensor data we had before, but now we found something curious. A Vergalen close air support gunship was shot down in that area near an isolated airfield. It was shot down by a Cobra, no question about it.
Vereni held out his tablet toward the general, running the video.
We don't have any people in that area except for whoever survived the dropship descent.
Ross liked hearing that their people, humans, were still fighting, despite having been dropped in the wrong area and being cut off from the Legion. Leaning forward to study the video, he squinted. What is an airfield doing way out there?
We think the squids were running an exercise. Sir, there was a battle at the airfield. We couldn't see details. What caught our attention is a helicopter later flew east from...
A helicopter? Like... Ross twirled a finger in the air. A helo?
Yes. The Wergalen use rotor-wing aircraft for heavy lift capability. They probably used the helo to set up the airfield, then brought in gunships.
Huh. Ross knew the Ruhar used blimps, really zeppelins, for airlifting heavy loads in an atmosphere. If the Legion was able to land a third wave, 3 zeppelins would be brought down from orbit and assembled. An airship could lift loads heavier than a whale dropship could carry, and use far less fuel.
Do we know where this helicopter went?
Sensors lost track of it, Vereni frowned. It is possible that whoever took the helo left a message at the airfield.
If our people won the battle, Ross said, to quell unwarranted enthusiasm. Still, if a group of humans survived their assault carrier being sliced in half, a dead stick descent in a damaged dropship, then attacked an enemy position and flew away in an unfamiliar aircraft, the Legion had to at least make an effort to make contact.
All right. I'm sold. Do we have any assets in the area?
No, it's fairly isolated, Vereni explained. There is a dodo on the ground that could fly over the area. They dropped off half of a ninja team, then took ground fire that made a turbine overheat. The crew is completing repairs. They should be back in the air within 20 minutes.
The Yachikai they're carrying. Ross disapproved of the nickname ninjas for the Yachikai, but he had given up trying to quash use of the popular term. What's their objective?
It's OBE. The French officer shrugged and used an American term. They were supposed to hit a logistics base, but the squids have already abandoned the place. They blew it up after they retreated. The ninjas are being retasked as a quick reaction force for their 6th Battalion.
Ross grimaced. Tell them to check out the smoke signals. I don't want a lot of time wasted there. Overfly the area, and if they don't pick up a signal quickly, they move on. Follow the flight path of that helicopter. The damn thing couldn't have flown far.
Yes, sir.
No transmissions from the site of the smoke signals?
None we can detect through the jamming. If the people down there only have suits, an aircraft would need to be within 30 kilometers to detect a signal.
Hell. Once again, Ross thought it was bitterly ironic that the Legion had access to some of the best communications technology in the galaxy, but the equipment could not overcome enemy jamming without specialized equipment. That the enemy was also being jammed by the Legion did not make him feel any better about the situation.
I wish our beetle friends were here.
Because their ships have better sensors? Verini guessed.
No, because they would love to bet on whether we'll find anyone alive down there. Morse code smoke signals coming from an area where no dropships landed? That's juicy action none of the beetles could resist.
Fixing the ugly bug was not as easy as using a plasma torch to weld together the metal sleeves of the tail rotor shafts. The plasma torch was too crude for creating elegant welds, wasting much of the material which dripped down to burn the inside of the tail boom housing. Irene was not confident in the result, so Derek clutched together superglue on top of the inadequate weld. Then, because even the high-tech alien glue was not best at withstanding the twisting force of torque, the joint between rotor shafts was wrapped in duct tape.
Duct tape?
To say Irene was skeptical was a gross understatement.
We're using duct tape? It's not duct tape like you'd find in any hardware store on Earth, Derek assured her, holding up the roll he had found stuffed under a seat in the ugly bug's cabin. This is high-tech nanofiber magic.
It's duct tape, she insisted.
We are trusting our lives to that?
Duct tape saved the Apollo 13 mission, Derek noted.
It will be fine. Come on, we'll load test it.
To the surprise of Irene, and if he were telling the truth, Derek also, the welded, glued, taped shafts held together during the load test. Irene insisted on the two pilots taking the helicopter up without passengers, flying circles around the island until she was satisfied the ugly bug was not immediately going to fall out of the sky. The left-right yaw lag between control input and response was nearly gone, causing butterflies in Irene's stomach. The rotor drive shafts must have been slipping since she first got the helicopter in the air. It frightened her how close they had come to death without warning. What other hidden dangers were inside the alien machine's mechanisms? When they set the ugly bug back down on the island and the platoon reboarded, Irene needed info from Perkins before she took the turbines out of idle.
Ma'am, what's the plan? I don't want to fly this thing any further than we have to. We can get to shore, but the ugly bug could fail without warning.
There's no reason to, Perkins began. Derek paused the navigation display.
Hidden flaws like the tail rotor shaft are a pilot's worst nightmare, Colonel. Strebik is right. We don't know if this piece of junk is airworthy. If we're going to risk the whole platoon falling out of the sky, there needs to be a reason.
We need to make contact with friendly forces. Perkins knew that was a hopelessly vague objective.
We're flying an enemy aircraft.
Irene wrapped her knuckles on the console in front of her. It made a cheap-sounding, hollow sound and wobbled on its mounting bracket.
Contact may come in the form of a missile. Our troops will shoot first and ask questions later.
What can I tell you, Strebik? Perkins was annoyed with her pilot, but more annoyed with herself. If any of the Legion landed in the correct spot on this godforsaken rock, they are to the east of us somewhere. Bonsu, can you use any of that alien gear in front of you to monitor signal strength? Derek knew there was a screen for that somewhere. He had scrolled through a menu on the console when he was trying to understand the navigation system.
Yeah, I can do that.
Colonel, we can't use any of the ugly bug's comm gear to contact our people. The comm system doesn't have the codes to establish a handshake for encryption with Legion systems.
We will rely on our suits when we get close enough, the CO explained.
She knew that was more of a hope than an actual plan.
All you have to do is tell us when we pick up a Legion signal strong enough to be within, say, 20 kilometers.
Derek's face took on a pained look. With the pervasive jamming, it would have to be more like 10 clicks to pick up a signal, ma'am. It would be easier to scan for weapons fire, and, hope we don't set down on the wrong side of the fighting.
With that gear, can you discriminate between Legion weapons and Regalin?
Derek pointed to the scuffed and cracked display of his console.
I'm lucky if I can get this thing to tell me which direction is north.
Perkins straddled the awkward perch she was forced to use as a seat and tugged a strap across her lap. In a crash, the strap would be of little use, but it would prevent her from being thrown forward into the pilots if they hit turbulence.
Do what you can. Strebik, the answer is we fly until we make contact or we run out of fuel. Or, she emphasized, you feel this thing isn't airworthy.
I'm serious about that. It's your call.
Seeing that busted prop shaft scared the shit out of me, too.
Great, thought Irene. I'm not confident the Hilo is airworthy now, but we can't stay on the island.
Telling herself she would look for a place to set down at the first sign of trouble, she took a breath and pulled the handle to engage the main rotor clutch.
Yes, ma'am.
The ugly bug droned onward, flying generally east, except when they needed to avoid Wargalan towns, and once they diverted south to cross a mountain range through the lowest altitude gap in the area. Coming gently over the crest of the ridge and being careful not to get caught in a downdraft on the lee side of the mountains, Irene whistled. Stretching north to south across the horizon were pillars of smoke.
Where there's smoke, there's trouble, she said, mostly to herself.
Where there was trouble, they might find the Legion.
Any ideas? Perkins asked, leaning forward to speak with the pilots.
Derek held up an index finger.
Give me a moment, Colonel. I'm trying to use this thing's rangefinder to zero in on those locations.
Okay. There are 5 within 100 kilometers.
What about those clusters of thick smoke on the horizon?
The smoke there was darker, and she expected that meant the incident that created the smoke was more recent.
Derek shook his head.
Those sources are over the horizon.
He checked the fuel state.
Too far. We can't get there unless we walk.
All right. Take us to the site closest to our flight path.
Derek transferred the guidance to Irene's console, and she gingerly guided the ugly bug's nose around to the new course. At first, flying the alien machine had been exciting, an opportunity she might never get again. Since they nearly fell into the lake, every maneuver reminded her how big and ungainly the helicopter was. Once, when she was little, a family friend who operated the Zamboni at the local ice rink invited her up to steer the thing when he was smoothing the ice at the end of the night. Flying the ugly bug felt like driving a Zamboni in 3 dimensions. With every aircraft, it was important to stay ahead of it, plan what you want the machine to do before you ask it to do what you want. With the ugly bug, she had to express her wishes vaguely when she moved the controls and be happy if the giant helicopter did something similar to her intentions. Part of the problem, she guessed, was the machine was designed to carry heavy loads, and a cargo pod filled only with the surviving members of the platoon was too light. The big rotor blades were flexing too much, making the ugly bug bounce rhythmically up and down. If the autopilot had been working, it might have been able to hold altitude without making her queasy, but most of the computer-controlled systems were offline.
Okay, coming up on the site 17 clicks, Derek reported. You want us to overfly, ma'am?
He asked with a tone that implied overflight would be a very bad idea.
No. Can we see anything from here?
The helicopter had an image enhancer, which gave a fuzzy view on the cockpit display. Derek craned his neck, checking whether the sensors of his own helmet could detect anything useful. They could not, not from that distance at low altitude. There was no way to get the helicopter's systems to talk with his helmet. They were based on deliberately incompatible technologies. With a flash of inspiration, he looked down at the magnified console display with his helmet's own image enhancer switched on, and the view jumped out at him.
It's a crashed dropship, ma'am, he reported.
Theirs or ours? Perkins asked, with both dread and hope.
If the downed spacecraft were Legion, the crew was probably dead, but the wreckage might contain intact communications gear.
Derek couldn't answer immediately. Several Wargalan dropship designs were copies of captured Ruhar equipment.
Hard to say from here. Looks like it augured in, he muttered. It went in nose first. It's bad. There's a crater. I'm looking at what's left of an engine. My guess is this is one of theirs.
The hope for finding hardened communications equipment went out the window with that announcement.
Next site is how far?
Unless we want to deviate due north from our eastward flight path, the next site is 22 clicks.
How far to the one north of us? It irritated her that, unlike aboard a friendly aircraft, she could not share what the pilots were seeing. 8 clicks to get a view of it. Turning her head to look out the grimy windows, she saw a thin trail of light gray smoke. Let's go there. It's close. That smoke was from a source easily identified. The spacecraft had come down in a meadow next to a stream, digging a long furrow in the soil before it broke in half when it reached the trees. One of ours, Derek said with confidence when they were 10 kilometers away. I recognize the tail configuration. That's one of ours, a Vulture gunship. It only holds 2 pilots. Perkins had a decision to make, and she didn't like her options. Does it look like anyone walked away? Can't tell from here. The Maverick's CEO mentally tossed a coin, then rejected that thought. Whatever she decided, she would do it for a logical reason. The Vulture must at least have an emergency locator beacon, so search and rescue ships could find it. The beacon set out an encoded signal, a crude message containing only "I am here" and the aircraft's identification code. Can you interpret the ELT message? Derek knew what Perkins wanted to know. If either of the pilots survived, their flight suits should have caused the emergency location transmitter to send a signal of "survivor here" rather than a simple beep. Knowing the helicopter's equipment would be useless, he queried his helmet. At least one survivor. Perkins did not want to stop. The platoon had a mission, and taking precious time to rescue a Ruhar who might be badly injured would take time they didn't have. On the other hand, the platoon's original mission, the entire plan for the invasion, was OBE. She might as well do some good while she had an opportunity. Strebik, set us down.
Ma'am, that clearing is not big enough to clear the rotor blades unless we're exactly in the center, Irene advised.
Right. Coulter, tell our medic to prepare to drop down on the line. We're going to hover. Send someone with him. Not you, she added, knowing the staff sergeant would want to volunteer. Too often, Coulter still thought like a private. It was a waste of time, effort, and fuel. One pilot had survived the crash, and she was still alive when the platoon's medic reached her, but died soon after the medic administered nanomed stabilizers. That was tragic for one person. The fact that the Vulture's comm system had been destroyed in the crash was frustrating to the platoon.
She had lost a lot of blood, the medic reported. Her heart gave out. Sorry.
Nothing to be sorry about, Maze, Perkins responded. Pull the plug on the ELT and get back here. She did not want a SAR team risking their lives for no reason. We don't have time for a burial. Perkins knew that decision would not be popular. Next site, Perkins said with weary determination once the 2 soldiers were back aboard. While the medic had been on the ground, there had been a blinding explosion in orbit, low in the eastern sky. Yellow streaks of fire were tracing across the sky overhead, the remains of the ship that had just died. She clenched her fists, overcome by frustration. The fight for Stiglord was still raging, and she was not a part of it. She had no idea what was going on. Was the Legion achieving its objectives despite loss of 2 assault transports, or had the invasion failed and the Legion's 3 parts were trying to pull out under fire? There was also an in-between possibility. The invasion could have stalled, in which case the second wave might be delayed or canceled. She simply didn't know anything. The situation was intolerable. Yet they had to go on.
Chapter 20 Nert suddenly halted, holding up a fist in a freeze gesture. Then his hand opened, palm facing down and waving toward the ground. Turning his head while he crouched on one knee, he held a finger to the faceplate of his helmet. Shauna and Dave froze and crouched down, waving for Jaitz and Chowdhury behind them to halt. Shauna looked at Dave and silently mouthed, "What now?" Glancing back to see that Jaitz and Chowdhury had ducked behind trees, Shauna slung her rifle in its holster and crawled forward to Nert's position, Dave right beside her. She tapped the cadet's shoulder. He spoke over the short-range laser link on the lowest power setting.
We have company, he whispered,
pointing to the stream valley that had been their destination.
They were on the east slope of a ridge that ran southeast to northwest, intending to get down to the stream that wound its way along on the east side of the ridge, separating it from the next line of low hills. The whole area was a series of rolling hills that lay across their path, covered with thick forest that made for slow progress. Getting down to the valley would give them fresh water, and they had to cross the valley anyway. Except where Nert pointed, four Wargalins splashed along the shallow stream, keeping to the sides and away from deep pools that swirled where the stream bent one way or another.
"What the hell are they doing here?" Dave groaned. "This is the middle of freaking nowhere."
"Looking for us," Jates guessed, crawling up to lie prone next to Dave. The four of them had cover provided by thick underbrush and a decaying log that lay in front of Nert. Shauna considered the situation. Three more Wargalin had come into view, out from a grove of trees clustered on the far side of the stream.
"I don't think so," she said. "Look, they're not wearing powered armor."
The Wargalin were dressed in baggy clothes that did not have any chameleon wear activated, so the dark gray color stood out from their surroundings. They all wore helmets with faceplates retracted, and what appeared to be armor panels attached to the clothing around their squat torsos.
"If they were sent out to look for us, their command deployed whoever they had in the area. They're not prepared."
"Shit," Dave exclaimed as more Wargalin came out of the woods, their shoes or boots or lower legs coated with mud. They all walked in the stream bed, single file, trudging along one behind the other. Dave studied their body language. Though they were aliens, he recognized an attitude that was universal to soldiers across the galaxy.
"Shauna's right. Those guys aren't looking for us, or anyone. Their rifles are slung. They're not keeping a watch on their surroundings. They think they're alone out here."
"More coming," Nert added. "That is 18? 19? 20?
The Wargalin in the front of the formation had halted where the bank of the stream rose higher, above the surrounding marsh. Climbing out of the stream, they unbuckled straps and shrugged off the small packs they carried. As their fellows reached the area, they all did the same. Some of the enemy looked up at the sky, where lights still flashed, and bright contrails burned from the ongoing air and space battle above their heads.
"You might be right," Jates sounded disgusted.
Even if the Wargalin had good reason to think they were alone in the area, that was no excuse for such poor discipline.
"What do you think, Sergeant?" Dave asked.
Jates had improved in mobility once he donned the spare skin suit, though his mood was not any better. An injection with nanomeds was probably the reason for his continued grumpiness, and Dave thought most of that was just Jates being Jates. The microscopic machines had directed themselves to Jates's injured leg and ribs, wriggling their way into the fractured bone and forming a solid rod inside to bring the bone back into the proper position and hold it there. The nanomeds were a miracle of advanced technology, highly effective and naggingly painful. Most likely, Jates had refused the offer of a nerve block.
"I think," Jates slowly lifted his head above the log to get a better view. "While the squids down there have a picnic, we should use this opportunity to go back up the ridge and turn south, keep the ridgeline between us and them. We'll cut south a kilometer or two."
"Oh, come on," Dave teased. "There's four of us."
He didn't count Chowdhury.
"And only 20 of them. You're not afraid, are you?"
Jates slowly turned to regard the human.
"Afraid? No."
"Then why?"
"Chaika." He shook his head sadly. "Do you have any idea how much a pain in the ass it will be to dig 20 graves?" "That would take all freaking day. We don't have time for that shit. Now, if you want to volunteer..."
Dave could feel his cheeks burning red with embarrassment. "I'm good."
Shauna patted his shoulder and began slowly crawling backwards.
"You heard the man, Chaika. We're sitting this one out."
"Yeah."
Dave tapped Nert's leg.
"What worries me is what are the odds we would run into the only group of squids in this area? If there are more of them around here, digging graves will be the least of our problems."
Whoa, slow down, stop, stop,
Danny ordered from behind the driver's seat. They had commandeered a van and two trucks, and taken time they didn't have to tear out the interior and windows of the van. The inside of the van had rows of saddle-type seats stacked one above the other on both sides, seats the Verds could not use, and the poles that held the upper rows of seats would get in the way. It had taken the platoon less than a minute to smash the windows, rip the seats from the floor, and toss them out. The two pilots were behind the platoon, driving in the opposite direction outside the city anywhere they could go quickly, bringing with them the people injured during the descent and rough landing. Danny had debated whether to send the platoon's medic with the pilots, before deciding to take the medic with her, reasoning that 3rd Platoon also had casualties, and she didn't know whether they had a medic or any medical supplies. She had sent 2 drones with the pilots, along with 4 soldiers who had only minor injuries. That group was regrettably on their own. The rest of the 2nd was with her. The van was in the middle of the 3-vehicle formation. In front was a sort of stake bed truck, behind a box truck that had its sides torn off.
"Tell the—" Danny groaned with frustration. "Bessalt, stop!"
The truck in front skidded to a halt.
"The drone is showing a roadblock up ahead," she explained, knowing that Bessalt, Alfex, and the soldiers operating the drones saw the same formation.
They had gotten lucky at the start. The area where the Dodo went down was industrial, and with the early morning timing of the invasion, that section of the city was relatively empty. The drones showed that in residential areas to the north and south, the streets were jammed with traffic streaming outbound, panicked citizens getting away from what they judged was a likely combat zone. All the vehicles they had found were autonomous, with guidance and speed controlled by a central network. All the vehicles also had manual backup controls, and enough drivers had engaged manual mode that accidents had snarled traffic. From the industrial area of the crash to 3rd Platoon's reported position, traffic was light, and drivers racing away from the city had gotten out of the way when Bessalt's squad in the lead truck fired warning shots. Now their luck had run out. An elevated highway ran across their path, with a confusing spaghetti bowl of on- and off-ramps going over and around each other. Several vehicles had crashed, blocking the straight route under the highway. The drone showed the tangled vehicles had been abandoned, with one truck rolled on its side. With their powered armor, the platoon's soldiers could have moved the traffic jam out of the way, but that would have taken too long. The intersection was a choke point. It could easily be blocked by the enemy when the platoon was retreating from the city. Really, she had been surprised how far they had gotten in the stolen vehicles. It was like the Wergalan were not paying attention to that part of the city. The few squid civilians they passed looked shocked and terrified to see armor-clad aliens in their midst. Some of the alert citizens must have contacted the authorities about the unlikely invasion of the city. The only reason Danny could imagine for why they had so far been driving unopposed was that the Wergalan were busy elsewhere, and one isolated understrength platoon was not a priority. From the twisting contrails overhead, pillars of smoke rising in every direction and the dull thump of explosions, she knew the Legion was fighting to establish a toehold on the planet and the natives were hitting back. Surely not all the assault carriers had been destroyed like the Dahl Ternadon, or the invasion would have failed before it started. With regret, she noted one nearby pillar of thick black smoke was from their dodo they had set to self-destruct once they got clear of the area. It had not been possible to take all the supplies with them, and she couldn't leave the deadly gear for the enemy to discover. That dodo had kept her alive against the odds. It felt like betrayal to blow it to pieces.
"We dismount here," she ordered, proud of herself for using proper terminology. "Pull the vehicles off the road."
She did not have much hope the van and trucks would be there when they retreated back through the area, but it didn't hurt to retain them as possible assets. Neither Sergeant argued with her decision. They had seen the drone images. 2nd Platoon with her was now 18 soldiers divided into 2 squads under Bessalt and Alfex, plus the medic and Danny. 21 alien warriors led by a human trained in psychology, not infantry tactics. They had to link up with the survivors of 3rd Platoon and extract them from the city to... where? How the hell were they going to get all the way out of the city without being blown to bits by artillery or blasted from the air? 3 times they had seen Wergalan aircraft racing by in the distance, so far not interested in the 3 stolen vehicles.
That could change in the blink of an eye. The platoon had two anti-aircraft teams, equipped with two launchers and six Ruhar missiles that UNEF had designated as Cobras for the speed and agility of the small weapons. On Fresno, Danny had seen Cobras take down enemy aircraft. She had also seen those missiles be intercepted and simply missed the target because of sensor jamming. Launching a shoulder-fired missile at an aircraft equipped with stealth energy shields, sensor jamming, and defensive cannons was not a certain kill. That was why UNEF told infantry anti-air teams to follow the artillery tactic of shoot and scoot, because as soon as the enemy detected a launch from the ground, they would retaliate. The two squads hopped out of the vehicles, gathering their gear, and set off down the road at a steady run. Danny stayed in the middle of Alfex's squad in the rear, running alongside their communications tech, a woman called Telered.
Any contact? No, Captain.
Telered had set her suit on semi-automatic, following the soldier in front of her at a preset distance so she could focus on contacting 3rd Platoon. There had been no word from the other unit since they left the warehouse.
I don't understand it, Danny fretted.
She had tasked a drone to fly forward and make contact with the 3rd, but they had lost contact with the drone when it was less than a kilometer from the other platoon's last reported position.
This is crazy, she said aloud, without intending others to hear her. Besalt, launch another drone.
Captain, he replied with a tone that even through the translator had a note of an adult being patient with a child. We only have 2 drones left.
I know that, she snapped. We are not proceeding until we have better intel. I am not taking us into an ambush.
Yes, ma'am.
Besalt issued orders, and a soldier in his squad stopped for a moment to take a drone from his pack, activate it, and toss it in the air.
We're sending the drone in from the north this time.
Good idea, she acknowledged.
The 3rds were trained infantry. She didn't need to tell them how to do their jobs, only what she wanted to accomplish. Give them a goal and get out of their way. The platoon ran under the highway, dodging around crashed cars and trucks and causing a commotion on the highway above when civilians trying to walk out of the city saw armor-suited aliens race past them. Only another 2 kilometers to go, Danny saw in her visor. Still no sign of armed opposition. They had passed through and out of the industrial area. The section of city they were running through then was low buildings that appeared to be retail shops or restaurants, with taller 3- or 4-story residential structures farther back from the street. Just past the highway, they ran around a crater in the street that was still smoking. All the windows in the area were shattered, and the concrete surfaces of buildings peppered with pockmarks. Something had crashed there, big and fast enough to leave a 2-meter-deep hole in the street. A fallen piece of starship? A downed aircraft? Theirs or ours? From the blackened, mangled debris in the crater, there was no way to tell. Danny was amazed at how calm she felt. She was surrounded by a group of big, hulking, menacing lizards, but that was really no different from any Friday night back on Earth, and the 3rds would not be getting hammered and spilling drinks on her, so, bonus. She was on an alien planet, but she had lived on Paradise for so long that no longer felt strange. She was running through enemy territory, and oddly, it felt like a training run on any military base, except for the signs in an alien language and occasional startled natives dashing out of their way. The whole situation felt unreal, as if,
"We have contact,"
Telered announced excitedly. "Halt," Danny ordered, waving the platoon to take cover in doorways or under awnings along the street.
"This is Ardva 2.
3 here."
The gravelly voice came through background static. Whoever it was, they sounded exhausted already. A burst of pop-pop-pop, where Gallen gunfire interrupted, followed by the heavier bark of a Kristang rifle. Then multiple Kristang rifles.
"What is your situation?"
Danny spoke slowly and clear.
"We're engaged with a police unit," the voice explained.
On Stiglord, police services were provided by the military. So effectively, the 3rd was fighting light infantry.
"We have 13 wounded, and 5 of us are still fighting. We had to move from our prior location. Do you see our position now?"
13 and 5? Those numbers were down from 15 and 8 the last time they had contact. The 3rd platoon was being ground down to nothing. Danny looked at the map overlay in her visor.
It showed a blinking yellow circle. The drone had determined Third's position within half a city block. Buildings and jamming interference made it impossible to fix the location with greater precision.
Can you send a visual feed?
The reply was a window opening in Danny's visor. The staticky video showed the shattered lobby of a building, a bank of elevators on one side with doors bent and bashed in. Windows along the street had blown inward, scattering glass all over the floor. The Third had piled up furniture, torn out slabs of interior wall, and any other junk they could find to barricade the window openings. From the narrow, jittery view, Danny guessed the image she was seeing was from a rifle scope. It showed a gap between broken wall panels into the street beyond. An intersection, with vehicles smashed, flipped over, and burning. Wargallen clad in dark blue and orange dashed one way and the other, firing rifles.
Ardva 3, are you pinned down in there? She asked with dismay, hoping an experienced infantry unit had not gotten trapped in a poorly defensible position.
We are surrounded, but there is a route out if we blow a sidewall, the voice replied. We can't move because the enemy has close air support above us.
As he spoke, Danny saw a large shadow slide across the intersection.
Three, hold.
Switching to a view from the drone, she saw a Wargallen gunship flying slow circles around the building, always keeping its nose pointed toward 3rd Platoon's position. Sponsons on each side of the aircraft were laden with rockets, and a cannon turret hung under the nose. If 3rd broke out into the open, they would be chopped to pieces. She cut off her helmet microphone to allow herself a private, "Shit, I hate my life!" Then she toggled the microphone back on.
Ardva 3, stand by.
We will stand by as long as we can,
the voice said over a chattering burst of rifle fire.
Sergeant Besson, you see that gunship? Can we hit it from here?
I see it, the Sergeant replied. Negative on launch from here. Our missiles need line-of-sight initial tracking to—
I know that.
She was getting a little sick of people assuming she didn't know anything.
The drone has line of sight to the target. Can we program the Cobras to follow a low observable flight profile until they pop up and get terminal guidance from the drone?
A slight pause.
Yes, we can.
Besalt's tone reflected surprise and a bit of shame. Surprise that their human leader knew technical details about the Cobra missile, and shame that he had not suggested the idea.
One moment, Captain.
Make it a short moment.
Besalt spoke again 28 seconds later.
Captain, we can program a missile to fly along the streets and remain below the top of buildings until it approaches the target and must pop up. We—
His voice cut off.
My team just reminded me that the missile will use most of its fuel before it pops up. Its terminal dash will be slower than normal. I suggest we task 2 or 3 missiles.
Two only, she declared. If we shoot down one of their aircraft, we'll have others swarming around us like we kicked a nest of hornets, she said,
remembering too late that human metaphors often did not translate well.
We will need the other missiles for self-defense.
When she first saw soldiers carrying a Cobra in addition to all their other gear, she had questioned the burden. Now she wished they were all carrying extra anti-air missiles.
Besalt, Alphix, soon as those missiles are away, we need to move out double quick.
Switching back to the drone, she called her besieged counterpart.
Ardva 3, this is 2. We'll be taking care of that gunship for you. Transmit your egress plan. We need to coordinate a meet.
2, copy that. Sending the plan now. We—
His voice was drowned out in a burst of gunfire and something louder. From the drone, she saw a fresh pall of smoke rising from the 3rd Platoon's position. They needed to hurry before the Wargallen police decided to pull back and have the gunship drop the building on the invaders' heads.
I see your plan. Stay off this channel. The squids might be able to track the drone.
The only reply was 2 clicks, acknowledging her instructions.
We are ready to launch, Besalt said.
Wait.
She studied the map, seeing the route the 3rd planned to take once the gunship was swept from the sky, trying to imagine where the groups could meet. The other platoon had 5 people to conduct a fighting withdrawal and carry 15 wounded. She should have asked how many of the wounded were capable of walking.
Okay, do it. Launch.
One missile was launched by each squad, small puffs of nearly invisible water vapor issuing from the launch tube as the missiles were kicked out. Their motors ignited, surging them up and forward as thin wings popped out on each side. Instead of the motors burning furiously to send the Cobras racing at full speed to strike their target, the motors pulsed, wasting fuel to keep the speed low enough that the weapons could make tight turns over the streets. At the second intersection they approached, the missiles split up, one banking hard to the right, the other going straight for another three city blocks, when it too made a right turn. Danny gasped with dismay when she saw one missile turn and not the other, thinking it was a mistake or malfunction. She was about to speak when she heard Alphax.
Missiles away. Tracking is nominal.
The missiles were supposed to split up. That made sense. Approach the target simultaneously from different directions. She would have known that if she had asked. No, the platoon leader did not need to get lost in details. The soldiers who had launched the missiles lowered the tubes from their shoulders and removed the targeting box, discarding the empty launchers. Second platoon, move, Danny ordered when a pop-pop-pop burst of gunfire from the left struck the soldier and Bessalt squad who had launched a Cobra. The soldier fell, losing the targeting box and rolling. Three soldiers from first squad opened up in the general direction of the shooter, sending a hail of explosive-tipped rounds through the already smashed window where the alien had fired from. Feeling useless, Danny allowed two soldiers to hustle her into the dubious protection of a doorway while first squad split up, one group providing cover fire while the other leapfrogged forward. Seconds later, she heard Bessalt announce,
"Clear!"
"Who was it?" Danny called.
"Looks like that was one local citizen trying to be a hero," Bessalt said with disgust.
The soldier who had been hit got slowly to his feet, giving a hand signal that he was all right. In Danny's visor, she checked that soldier's status, and his mech suit was showing a few spots of yellow, nothing the nano couldn't repair or bypass. She heard Bessalt talking softly on the squad channel, then,
"Captain, we have a problem. My squad's Cobra targeting box is damaged. We have four missiles, and only one effective launch control system."
"Shit. Well, let's be extra careful with the other one. Second platoon, move out." The two Cobra missiles flew at speeds far below their designed optimum, making turns that stressed their thin wings, dashing along the streets below the rooftops. The tiny brains of the missiles were technically not large enough for self-awareness, but the two semi-intelligent AIs were each thinking that they were having not only the most fun they had ever imagined, they were having the most fun that was possible. One missile banked too hard and so slow. Its wing ducked between two buses that had collided and were stuck in the middle of an intersection. Yes, maybe that missile was showing off a bit, but who could blame it? The missile had existed for endlessly dull years, awaiting a few all-too-brief seconds of raging excitement before ending its life in fire.
"Did you see that?"
the first missile transmitted over the spotty tactical link they were using to coordinate the strike.
"I flew between two vehicles."
"I saw it."
The second missile groaned as it dipped under a bridge, narrowly clearing the roof of a truck.
"That proves I am incredible," the first missile said with smug satisfaction. "It proves you are a dick," the second missile retorted. "You're just jealous."
The second missile ignored the taunt.
"It's been nice knowing you. I'm approaching from the northwest."
"Good luck," replied the first missile. Then there was no more time for chatting over the tactical link. The first missile came in from the north, having made a 90-degree turn at the last moment to swing behind 3rd Platoon's position 2 blocks away. The missile got its last guidance from the unseen drone hovering to the north, and its tiny brain calculated that its best tactic was actually to slow down, so it side-slipped, skidding through the air over the street. Its airspeed dropped it almost into a stall before the motor pulsed again weakly, its fuel almost expended in the wastefully slow flight. The delay gave time for the enemy gunship to come into view above the intersection. Its nose pointed toward the building where 3rd Platoon had taken refuge. Gunfire poured into the building from across the intersection, and the missile regretted not being able to do anything about that. With the last surge of power from its nearly depleted motor, it discarded its wings and went ballistic. The gunship's threat detection system lit up with confusion, unable to understand how a threat could be approaching from street level.
Its defensive cannon turret had barely begun to swivel around when the missile scored a direct hit, the alien weapon's warhead detonating when it impacted the aircraft's energy shield. Burning plasma bored through the shields, splattering against the cockpit canopy and burning through the composite material, the bodies of both pilot and gunner, and flash-frying every piece of electronics in the cockpit. Backup systems attempted to compensate, feeding power to the engines, but their thrust was uncoordinated and the flight control systems had lost awareness of where the aircraft was. Desperately, the backup computer lifted the nose to climb and turned to the left, smashing the gunship nose first into the eighth floor of a 12-story building. The armored bulk of the craft hammered through the skin of the building, crushing walls and floors into the building's core where the main structural beams clustered. Six of eight stout beams were bent and severed, and the building above the eighth floor tilted. Then the wreckage of the gunship slid backward out into the air over the street, leading the way as the entire facade of the structure sagged and collapsed, the front half of the building falling on itself.
Holy sh! The second missile thought as it dipped its nose to fly under the falling corpse of the gunship that had been the target.
Scratch one gunship, it mused, switching to a secondary objective it just identified. In its programming, the location of 3rd Platoon was highlighted, with strict instructions to avoid collateral damage in that direction.
Yeah, like that is going to happen, the missile thought bitterly.
The building across the street, that had recently suffered extreme and involuntary remodeling by gunship, was in the process of collapsing.
Good luck avoiding collateral damage there, the missile smirked, calculating that the maneuver it needed to make was going to snap its wings off and adjusting course to account for that loss.
The missile dived to street level, banking in a 120-degree right turn. At 101 degrees through the turn, the left wing buckled, and the missile instantly discarded both wings, vectoring its thrust to continue the turn, the nose cone slewing around violently and lining up with its secondary target, the cargo trailer of a truck that was stuck in the war zone of the intersection. Instead of the planned fragmentation mode most often used for anti-air missions, the missile instructed the warhead to direct all of its explosive force in a narrow cone forward. Just before it slammed into the trailer and was obliterated, the missile's tiny brain reflected on its existence and decided it had only one regret: that no one witnessed its supremely spectacular final act. By striking the truck, the missile added the frozen fish in the trailer to the shrapnel being propelled outward by the explosion. On the other side of the intersection, most of the Wargalan military police unit had taken shelter, massing for a final assault against the group of alien invaders. Their light armor panels were no protection from the frozen fish parts that impacted at hypersonic speeds, especially as many of the police had turned to run away from the collapsing building and their armor panels were thinner on the backside. 20 of the 21 police mercifully were killed instantly, never realizing what happened. The last officer, having arrived late and running toward the makeshift barricade, had a brief moment of asking a shocked, "What the f-" in his own language, when he was killed by the severed head of a frozen fish traveling at Mach 2. Inside the lobby of the mixed-use building, Sergeant 3rd Class Arconda stood poised to trigger explosives that would blow a hole in the sidewall of the building. He was waiting for a signal from 2nd Platoon, or simply the sound of the damned gunship being struck by a missile. The plan was for Arconda and another soldier to provide cover fire, while the other three combat-capable soldiers led a retreat of the wounded who were able to walk. 9 of the 15 injured were capable of walking with the assistance of their damaged mech suits, though none of them could move with any speed. Arconda did not know of anything he could do for the 6 more seriously wounded people, and they understood their fate. The team leading the retreat was supposed to look for a working vehicle, though the streets were so jammed with crashed cars, trucks, and buses that it was unlikely they could drive far. It was not a good plan. It was the only plan Arconda could think of, given the unforgiving facts. The wounded soldiers who could not move would hold their position, drawing the attention of the police, while the others conducted a fighting retreat. If the plan worked, and 2nd Platoon could fight its way through, he could save 14 people, including himself. 14 out of the entire platoon, plus the 2 pilots. When the trapped soldiers could no longer hold the position, they would detonate a pile of rockets, destroying the building and granting a merciful end to the suffering of the seriously injured.
Safety protocol was why Arkanda had a two-step process to trigger the explosives for blowing the sidewall, a wide precaution that prevented disaster. When he heard and felt a bang from above, the building shook, and he released the first safety device, waiting to hear the crash of the gunship. Instead, he heard its engines whine loudly, then an odd crumpling sound. For a brief moment, there was near silence before a thunderous roar. Dust, chunks of concrete, and other debris shot through gaps in the barricade they had set up where the building's ground floor windows had been, blinding Arkanda. The whole building shook with a second explosion outside, and the front of their building fell inward, along with part of the sidewall. Explosives were not needed after all. Arkanda had to duck and cover, taking shelter from smoke, flames, thick choking dust and debris that pinged off the top of his helmet, rattling his brain and causing spots in his vision. When he could see again, his suit's sensors warned that the ceiling above him was sagging and in danger of imminent collapse. Moving carefully so he didn't bump into a column that was shakily holding up the ceiling, he crawled out from under a pile of debris and toggled open his microphone.
Ardva 2, this is 3. Did you just nuke the city?
Danny replied, slowing her pace.
Not that I know of.
She checked the feed from the still hovering drone.
Holy shit!
The city intersection that had become an unlikely battle zone was wreathed in thick smoke and dust, but she could see that an entire building was missing. What the hell?
Ardva 2, we are out of here. 3, out.
Captain, Alphex called.
Did what I think just happened happen?
Besalt chimed in.
I think we destroyed a building. Captain, we were supposed to avoid collateral damages. We will catch hell from the Ruhar.
Hey, the hamsters can garnish my freaking paycheck to replace that building,
Danny said with vehemence, surprising herself. When had she gotten so macho? Maybe she was simply tired of dealing with bullshit beyond her control. She hadn't sliced the Tall Dernadan in half. She had not crashed 3rd Platoon's dropship in the center of the city, and she hadn't provided a tempting target by flying a gunship low and slow over a crowded city.
Maybe we'll get lucky and not survive this op,
Alphex said with gallows humor.
Then UNEF will have to pay for the damage.
Sergen, if you die, I am totally blaming the whole thing on you.
Danny replied, and was rewarded with laughter over the platoon channel.
Besalt, see if you can move the drone in closer. I need to see where 3rd is going.
The drone approached the thick gray smoke that obscured the intersection, and they picked up 3 transponder signals from Legion mech suits when the drone stopped transmitting. After half a minute, Besalt reported,
"That's not jamming. We just lost the drone."
Truly, Danny was amazed the drone had lasted so long in a hostile environment.
Ardva 3, we need your position. Report.
She stumbled and dropped to the ground as an aircraft roared by close overhead. From the glimpse she got, it was another Wargalan gunship. The Hornets were swarming, and they were pissed off.
Alphex!
On it, Captain. You should take cover,
the Verd woman warned as her squad's anti-air missile team dashed off the street into a small park. Danny didn't waste time with a reply that would only have been a distraction to the people focused on their jobs. Scrambling toward what looked like an office building, she jumped and crashed through the street side windows, skidding across the floor and bumping into the weird furniture used by the squids. She had just come to a stop and was getting to her knees when a soldier flew through the window and smacked into her, knocking her down again. She did not lose her rifle, a fact that might have been a virtue of the suit computer. When she got untangled from soldier and furniture, the Verd pressed down on her shoulder.
You should keep down, Captain.
If I'm on the floor, I can't see anything, she protested.
It's dangerous to...
If a gunship drops a missile out there...
Danny pushed herself upright, holding the broken remains of a desk.
Will this desk protect me?
No, the soldier admitted.
Great. Now,
she checked the icon in her visor, which informed her of the soldier's name.
Vist Humphrey. I don't need a bodyguard.
That's not...
The Verd soldier began to object.
Sergen Alphex told me to assure you are safe.
Danny crawled over to the broken window and propped her rifle barrel on the frame.
This is a war zone. No one is safe.
Across the street in the park, two soldiers had just completed setting up a Cobra missile. A soldier raised the weapon to her shoulder as Danny heard the sound of the enemy aircraft growing louder and higher in pitch. It was coming back for a strafing run. There was a faint puff of steam from water vapor in the air heated by the Cobra's launch. Then the weapon was away, rocketing upward without bothering to deploy its wings. The soldiers must have fired blind. They couldn't have a view of the target yet. Launch of the Cobra was intended to warn the enemy away, showing that the alien invaders on the ground had sharp teeth and were dangerous. Danny lost sight of the missile as it soared up into the sky in a pop-up maneuver so it could get a view of the target. There was a chattering sound, and Danny flinched instinctively, anticipating shells chewing up the street. But nothing impacted within her view. There was more chattering that became so rapid it was a buzz, then a boom rocked the area, shattering windows in the building and raining glass down on Danny and Humphrey. When she shifted to get a better view, glass crunched under her armored knee, and she idly noticed it looked like real glass, not any high-tech composite. Why didn't... Oh. She guessed that actual silica-based glass was cheap and good enough for civilian applications. That was Intercept, Alphex reported, her disappointment evident. Missile was destroyed without striking the target. Second platoon, Danny ordered, stepping out of the window frame onto the street and waving with her free hand. She was not an infantry officer, but she did know one thing. Firing the Cobra might have discouraged the enemy from a strafing run, but the gunship probably had standoff weapons and knew where the Cobra had been launched from. Across the street, she saw the anti-air team soldiers had already discarded the empty launch tube and were attaching the targeting box to another tube. Move, move, move! Get out of here! Her order was not needed. The two Sergeants had their squads running. Humphrey was just behind Danny. They followed Besalt's squad up the street and turned left at the first intersection. Several soldiers turned and dropped to one knee, rifles pointed at the sky as the other squad ran through. Just before the street they had left was rocked by explosions and fire. Boom, 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 boom! The cluster munitions rained down, shaking the ground under Danny's feet and shattering windows all around. The enemy certainly wasn't concerned about collateral damage to their own city. Right behind the munitions, the gunship raced by low and fast, flying through the smoke created by its own weapons. She only caught a passing impression of a sleek shape as the enemy aircraft flashed by along the main street.
Their sensors might have seen us, Besalt warned, waving his troops to move.
They were on a side road, with blocks of two- or three-story buildings connected together in sets. Alleys cut through the middle of the blocks, and Danny found it odd that the alleys looked no different from such urban features in any city on Earth. Dumpsters lined the sides. Trash had been blown into corners by the wind. Puddles of water filled low spots. Sidewalks along the streets had trees spaced evenly, with shrubs growing around the base of the trees. The odd architecture that tended to use curves instead of angles looked like a city in a Dr. Seuss book, with buildings leaning and appearing to sag toward each other. Following Besalt's lead, and with her babysitter Humphrey right on her heels, Danny ducked down an alley, pushing off one wall so hard that her powered gloves knocked a chunk out of the concrete-like material. Ahead of her, a soldier slipped on a slick puddle and bounced off the same wall, his armored shoulder sending a shower of concrete pebbles to ping off Danny's faceplate. The alley came to a dead end, a fact that did not bother the soldiers leading the squad. One of them used his powered legs to kick in a solid metal door and send it flying away inside the structure beyond, barely slowing down. The rest of the squad ran in single file, with Danny and then Alphex's squad trailing. It was a convenience store, although one that also sold clothing and small electronics. By the time Danny ducked through the too-low doorway, the interior was already a shambles, both from the flying door and from soldiers knocking over racks of display cases. She looked down to see she was standing on brightly colored packages of what she guessed was snack food. The package had a cartoon image of a Wargalan reaching into the bag with a tentacle, pulling out some disgusting purple hairy things, presumably to eat. Revolting. Although the Wargalan would probably say the same thing about a bag of Funyuns, and Funyuns were unquestionably delicious. In front of her, Soldiers were crouching down instead of running out the front door to the other street or smashing through the windows.
Sergeant, why aren't we?
The answer came in the form of a fireball blasting through the open doorway behind her, staggering her, and she would have toppled forward if not for Humphrey using a free hand to hold her upright. She turned to see burning debris in the alley and two soldiers down. They rose to their knees, then feet, and trotted forward to collapse through the doorway. In her visor, Danny saw the status overlay for both soldiers showing numerous yellow indicators of minor damage to their mech suits. The biological beings within were showing normal readings, though Danny knew from personal experience that the suits did not register painful bumps, bruises, and joints strained from overextension. The wall of one building had partially collapsed into the alley, and one dumpster was tipped over at a 45-degree angle, the trash inside burning so furiously that items spurted into the air, sending flaming garbage to fall into the ruined alley. Looking at the dumpster fire, she shook her head.
That describes this whole freaking op, she muttered to herself.
What was that, Captain?
Bessalt asked, tapping the side of his helmet.
Nothing. We're not hiding in here for long, are we?
She forgot that she was filling the role of platoon leader.
No, we...
His voice was drowned out by a chainsaw-like buzz of the gunship coming in for a strafing run on the street at the open end of the alley. The pilot and gunner must have thought their standoff weapons had killed the platoon, or at least made them keep their heads down. A shadow raced past, and the whining sound of the gunship's engines dropped in pitch. When the sound steadied, Denny eye-clicked through a threat assessment menu in her visor. Her suit computer was trying to plot the gunship's location and course based only on sound. The enemy was coming back for another strafing run, and from the echoes off the ground, it was flying low. That, she thought, was a result of the platoon firing a Cobra. The enemy pilot was hugging the ground to avoid providing an easy target for a missile.
Basalt, can we...
On it, the alien replied tersely, barking orders to his squad.
They ran out into the alley, hugging the wall on the right where the gunship was approaching from. The platoon tactical network showed that all the soldiers in the squad had their rifles synced with their Sergen, rifles aimed high and low toward the opening of the alley. As the engine whine grew in intensity and pitch, soldiers from Alphex's squad scrambled into the alley, sinking their rifles to Bessalt.
Should I?
Danny took a step forward, but Humphrey tugged her arm.
Please remain here, Captain. We fight. You lead,
the soldier added gently.
Right.
There was another angry chainsaw sound, and the street beyond the alley was ripped by cannon fire, chewing into the buildings on both sides and sending more debris raining down into the alley. The soldiers all held their positions without flinching, and their rifles fired in unison when Bessalt pressed the trigger of his weapon. As the shadow of the gunship flashed past low over the rooftops, it ran into a hail of explosive-tipped rounds from more than a dozen Kristang rifles on full auto. The engagement was over in the blink of an eye. All weapons ceased fire when Bessalt lifted his finger off the trigger of his weapon. Immediately, the engine whine changed, becoming intermittent, the turbines sputtering.
Wait!
Bessalt held up a hand, two fingers extended in the Verdcris signal to hold position. In Danny's visor, the predicted location of the enemy aircraft kept growing farther and farther away, the sound dwindling. According to the acoustic sensors of her helmet, the gunship had shunt down one engine, and the other was throttled back, its turbine blades wobbling.
Negative on a kill,
Bessalt pronounced with disappointment.
We don't need a kill, Danny reminded the squad leader. You got that hornet off our backs. Hopefully it will warn the others that we can sting, too. That was outstanding work. Tell your people.
Will do. Captain, we should move out.
Right.
Second platoon filed quickly out the doorway of the store, leaving the front windows intact, so if the enemy came back, there would not be visible evidence the invaders had been there and survived to escape. As they resumed advancing to hopefully link up with third platoon, Alphex came forward to run alongside Danny.
Captain, we can't use that trick too many times.
Danny knew what the Sergen meant.
If we are too big a threat, the squids will stop screwing around and drop warheads on our foreheads.
Captain?
Danny winced. She kept forgetting that slang did not reliably translate well.
The squids will call in artillery on an airstrike, take out 2 or 3 blocks around where they think we are.
Yes.
Let's hope.
She looked up at the sky, where twisting contrails and bright flashes told her a battle was raging. That the enemy has bigger things to worry about than one understrength platoon out for a morning run in the city.
She hoped the air battle over the city would prevent the enemy from having a stealth aircraft circling high above her, beyond range of the Cobra launcher's targeting system. That, at least, was one less threat she needed to worry about. If Alphex had concerns that hope was no substitute for a plan, she kept that thought to herself. What Danny did need to worry about was not having any contact with 3rd Platoon since the drone had been destroyed. The 3rd could have been wiped out, captured, or been forced to go in a different direction. She could be leading her platoon into extreme danger for nothing, and she wouldn't know until it was too late. So far, they had encountered only light opposition, and that was not only a matter of luck. The Wirgalin truly were not focused on a small group of light infantry.
Trouble, a scout called from ahead. There's another group of civilians here.
Chapter 21. The ugly bug flew toward the next pillar of smoke, holding more or less a straight line. There was no point to zigzagging. If either side cared about the slow, clumsy flying helicopter, the defenseless aircraft could easily be shot down. Appearing harmless was the platoon's best chance of survival. A line of hills stretched northwest to southeast across their flight path. Irene increased altitude to comfortably clear a saddle between 2 cone-shaped hills. Ancient volcanoes, her mind idly informed her with that day's trivia lesson. Volcanoes eroded down to nothingness.
Huh, Derek said, lifting his hands off the console.
What? Irene asked, not daring take her eyes off her own instruments.
Compass has gone haywire. It's acting like mad gear.
Perkins leaned forward, with the big rotor blades going thwack, thwack, thwack overhead loudly enough that it was rattling her brain even through the helmet. She hadn't heard correctly.
The compass has gone mad?
No, ma'am, Derek explained. MAD, like magnetic anomaly detector. That's how our sub-hunting planes back on Earth find enemy submarines under the surface. The steel hull creates a magnetic field. Hold your course, he advised Irene. I'll try to fix... The helicopter's cockpit was suddenly bathed in multicolored light, then plunged into utter, featureless blackness. Irene yelped as the ugly bug bounced upward, her instruments useless, her view of the horizon lost. She had to fly the helicopter entirely by feel, which was impossible. Amateurs think they can fly using their own sense of balance. Professional pilots know better. Irene remembered an instructor giving the class a quick exercise in flight school. Stand on one leg, tilt your head back to look straight up. Now close your eyes. She fell into the student next to her, who was falling backwards. If the ugly bug's instruments did not give her an idea of which way was up and which was down, they were going to roll and find out the hard way. The artificial horizon instrument had power. It wasn't doing anything reliable. Neither was the turn and bank indicator. It told her the helicopter was already on its side, and she knew that wasn't right. The independent sensors in her helmet had also glitched, giving contradictory statuses. Heart in her throat, she tried to fly by the seat of her pants, literally trying to judge which butt cheek was feeling more pressure, except she was straddling the awkward. Sunlight came back. The light had been gone for such a short time her pupils hadn't dilated. That was good. The light wasn't blinding, and her helmet's visor compensated. What was not good was seeing the ugly bug was nose up at 20 degrees and rolling to the right at 15 degrees, airspeed rapidly bleeding off. To her right, the big rotor blades beat at the air, the flexing tips reaching out for the hillside.
Babe,
Derek warned, feeding full power to the rotor blades. The rest was up to Irene. They were going to either roll over or stall. Neither was recoverable, especially at the tree-scraping altitude. Coordinating her control inputs in the unfamiliar aircraft, she pushed the stick forward to swing the nose down, building up airspeed to avoid stalling.
the big rotor blades automatically changed pitch, taking bigger bites of air with every rotation. Steadying the roll and getting the helicopter on an even keel, she felt the craft shudder as tree branches slapped at the cargo pod and the landing gear dragged through treetops. What saved them was the hillside falling away sharper than the helicopter was descending. Suddenly, they were in clear air, flying straight and normal.
That, Derek clenched his teeth to keep them from chattering, was great flying.
That was luck, Irene admitted. I hope we didn't break anything.
Was that a nuke? Perkins asked, her eyes still blinking away the initial flash of light.
No, Derek declared. We just flew through a stealth field.
Theirs, he added.
Why was it bright?
That's from the hologram, he explained, one eye on Irene and one on his console. The instruments were returning to normal.
The stealth field bends light around it, so we can't see what's really under there. The stealth field is wrapped in a hologram that projects a false image. We flew through the hologram first, then inside the field. We were lucky we just caught the edge of it, is my guess.
You're damned right about that, Irene agreed.
The bug doesn't feel any different. I don't think it suffered mechanical damage.
Perkins checked the map in her visor.
Why is there a stealth field way out here?
Plasma cannon? Derek guessed.
Got to be, Irene agreed quietly.
The stick had developed a flutter. Or was she imagining that?
The pre-invasion bombardment knocked out all of the plasma cannon clusters, Perkins repeated what the Ruhar fleet commander had told her.
Apparently they missed one, Derek snorted. What have the hamsters not been wrong about?
Perkins wasn't convinced. If there's a cluster of plasma cannons here, their defenses would have shot us down.
Not without giving away their position, ma'am, Derek countered. Plus, we're a friendly aircraft.
Are we squawking IFF codes? Irene asked.
We're not squawking anything that I can see.
Derek waved a hand at his console.
Maybe it's on a menu I haven't found yet.
If the helicopter's comm system was responding to identification friend or foe requests from the Rogallan, it was doing it automatically.
One thing's for sure. If anyone down there was asleep, we woke them up.
You know what? That's odd.
What is? Perkins asked.
A stealth field is a hazard. It should be highlighted on this thing's navigation system.
We flew right into it.
Must be a secret, Irene suggested.
Of course it's a secret. It has to.
Oh.
Derek's lips drew into a tight line. Shit. It looks like we are flying through a restricted zone. This whole area is restricted if I'm reading this damn thing right. It doesn't say why.
Perkins made a snap decision. Strebik, take us north around this hill. I want to set down somewhere that isn't line of sight to the plasma cannon.
While they walked, Dave Chaika somehow got an old song stuck in his head. It was a good song. He enjoyed it. He did not like his stupid brain repeating it over and over. His father had told him that one way to get rid of an earworm was to sing it aloud and let it get stuck in someone else's head.
I shot the sheriff, he sang out of tune. But I did not shoot the deputy. Oh, yeah, he ad-libbed.
What? Jates turned toward him suddenly. Chaika, do you think that the authorities will go easier on you because you only shot one law enforcement official?
What?
Dave halted, holding up his hands.
No, man, it's just...
Jates unslung his rifle, keeping the muzzle pointed at the ground.
You idiot. You have confessed to a serious crime. I am required by our code of justice to apprehend you. We are in a combat zone. Why didn't you wait until...
No, I... Dave stuttered. It's just a song.
You could have composed your confession in the form of an epic poem, Jates shook his head. And it would not change the facts of your crime.
Shauna, Dave pleaded. Come on, help me out here. You gotta explain it to him.
Shauna hung her head, avoiding Dave's eyes.
David Chaika, I thought I knew you.
Her voice cracked.
You know one of my uncles is a police officer. How could you?
Whoa. Dave's panic meter went to 11.
Jates, Sergen, you gotta believe me. It's just, you selfish jerk, Jate snarled. You could have waited until the operation was over, but no. You had to get it off your chest now and dump the burden on us. Why, whoa, whoa! Dave waved his hands, keeping them in sight and away from his rifle. Listen, Jates, seriously. Jates slung his rifle. Chaika, I was screwing with you. Damn, you are so freaking gullible. Oh, Dave sputtered. Oh, that is not... Stop. Jates held up a fist. You hear that? Nert answered first, tilting his head as if that would help him hear better inside his helmet. Instincts were hard to overcome.
Maybe.
I don't hear anything. Shauna boosted the volume. Still nothing.
It's an aircraft, Jates declared with confidence. Dave looked at Shauna. They all wore helmets with the same acoustic sensors, but the genetically enhanced hearing of Jates and Nert gave them an advantage.
If you say so. Dave kept his tone neutral, not displaying irritation at the aliens showing off for the humans. Stilling his breathing, he concentrated. There was a faint droning sound. Swinging his head side to side, he looked to the north-northeast.
That direction?
Correct.
Jates looked around. We should get undercover.
None of the others argued with that notion. Unfortunately, that area of the forest was relatively flat and featureless, with no overhanging rocks or caves they could hide under. Shauna pointed to a fallen tree where large roots torn out of the ground created a crater.
Only two of us can fit in there. Chaika, help Chowdhury get in there.
Dave wanted to protest, but the injured woman did need help, and none of them could do anything useful if they were being hunted by a Wargalan aircraft. After he lowered himself into the muddy hole under the tree roots next to Chowdhury, he watched the others scatter to avoid leaving an easy, compact target zone for the enemy. They all took positions so that everyone was within line of sight of one other person, so their helmets could communicate via low-power laser bursts. With nothing else to do, Dave played with the suit's threat assessment controls, trying to identify the incoming aircraft. Nothing worked. The system could not find a match. That was odd. The Legion only had a dozen types of vehicles capable of operating in an atmosphere, and all types of Wargalan air and airspace craft were in the identification database. Puzzled and anxious, he began trying to get the system to tell him what type of aircraft was the closest match, which the computer seemed reluctant to do. The source of his anxiety was not concern about being targeted by the enemy. He was worried about a Legion aircraft being in the area and never noticing them. A war was raging to the east, and Dave might as well have been on a camping trip in the wilderness. He wanted to know where M was, and he wanted to be there. Help her. Protect her. What the hell was he thinking, letting her put herself into danger when... Scratch that. He did not let Emily Perkins do anything. He had no authority over her. She was no doubt just as worried about him. Maybe after the invasion was over one way or another, the two of them needed to talk about doing something else for a living. Fighting for his country, his species, was one thing. Risking his life to intervene in disputes between aliens was making less sense to him with every deployment. The only reason he kept going, kept signing on, was that Emily was going. And although she never said anything directly, he suspected she had a plan, like PLAN in all capital letters. Whatever it was, she hadn't told him. Maybe that was because he was a contractor. Maybe it was because his effective rank was that of a staff sergeant, and it was above his pay grade. Dave decided right then and there that if, when, they got back together, things were going to change. Startled, he realized that while he had been daydreaming, the suit computer had complied with his instructions. Text reading, Lotentix, was scrawling across his visor.
What the hell is...
Oh yeah, he mumbled, remembering the official Ruhar designation for that type of dropship.
Hey guys, he called out. IFF says the closest match is a Dodo with a damaged engine.
A reply came back from Jates immediately.
A Dodo must be one of ours. How can you be sure?
I can't be sure, Dave groaned. It's a 51% match. The next closest match is, He scrolled down. 29%. That's for a squid gunship that UNEF calls a warthog.
Let me ping them, Chowdhury spoke.
Jates vetoed that suggestion.
We can't have anyone.
I can barely walk, and it hurts, the Indian soldier insisted. I am slowing you down.
Dave worried that somehow he had given her the impression that she was a burden.
You're not slowing us down because we're not going anywhere.
Chowdhury was not deterred.
If I ping them and they're hostile, the four of you can scatter and evade. I have tried not to complain, but every step I take hurts so bad I can barely see. The suit won't give me any more nerve blockers.
It makes sense, Nert said.
No one asked for your opinion, cadet, Jate snapped.
She is right,
Shauna came to Nert's defense.
One of us has to attempt to make contact. If we had a drone, we could launch it, but we don't.
Jates stepped out from behind the leaning tree where he had taken cover.
I will not risk the life of—
Hey! Dave was growing irritated. Newsflash for you, Sergeant. We are all at risk. We signed up for risk when we agreed to join this crap operation. Right now, we're at risk without doing anything useful. There are people out there who need us. I don't like the idea of hiding under a freaking tree while the Legion is doing who knows what. Chowdhury is right. It sucks to say that, but she's right.
Under the tree roots, he extended a hand, and she bumped his fist. Jates was silent for a beat.
I must balance the needs of two other species and the relations of my people against—
Bullshit, Shauna interjected. If you're leading this squad, leave the politics out of it. We're infantry. General Ross can handle the consequences if any of us get killed down here. That's why he gets the big bucks.
Switching to a private channel, she assured their Verdcris leader.
Jates, if this were an all-Verd unit, what would you do?
He sighed. I would commend Chowdhury for her bravery and initiative.
Over the squad channel, he spoke with authority, ignoring the debate they just had.
Chowdhury, good idea. Chaika, get your ass out of there. We need to disperse.
Thanks.
Dave patted the other soldier's shoulder as he wriggled out from under the tree roots. The four scattered, racing through the forest, getting as far away as they could within the 90 seconds Chowdhury would wait. Nert came to a stop at a stream, judging whether to run farther during the 18 seconds remaining. No, it was just more forest. The stream cut a meter-deep channel in the flat ground, giving him some sort of cover. Immersing himself in the stream's cold water would help mask the infrared signature of his suit, so he lay down in a pool and waited. And waited. And waited. 3 minutes after Chowdhury was supposed to attempt contacting the mystery aircraft, he sat up, his helmet above the water. Some type of amphibious lizard animal was startled by his appearance, leaping off a rock into the water.